From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
The idea that there's, you know, the it girl in Hollywood, there's no it boy. Like, we are living in a culture of one woman at a time is allowed to have power, and that's it.
Prolific writer, director, producer Ryan Murphy is on a mission. He has a lot of shows on FX, American Crime Story, American Horror Story, and his latest, Feud. And he wants half the people working behind the camera to be women or minorities. He talks about the inspiration behind those efforts and the first cycle in his Feud series, which focuses on the bitter rivalry between Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. He also explains why he's at work on series about Charles and Diana, as well as Monica Lewinsky and the 2016 election. But first on the news banter, Hollywood is having a breakdown. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my banter associate, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, I've been at this for a while, a few years covering Hollywood. I've never seen anything like the environment right now. There are two studios, Sony Pictures and Paramount, that are leaderless as we are taping. It could change possibly any day now, any minute now, but they have not announced a leader at Paramount. Sony, there's this odd silence. Michael Lynton is supposedly sort of there, but really is not going to be there and not remaining as head of Sony Pictures. And Time Warner is being acquired, presumably, if the deal goes through, which we think it will, by AT&T. And most people in the industry are expecting change at Warner Brothers as well. And then Legendary, I'll just throw that in. Legendary, which was Thomas Tull's company, sold in a splashy deal to Wanda. They got rid of Thomas Tull, and Mary Parent is now the head of production running, doing this on her own, but they said they want a CEO. All of these jobs are going begging. And there's this overheated environment of rumor like I've never seen before, unreliable rumor, and just fear, not just about the instability at the studios, but what does it mean for the industry?
Right. And I think that it does mean a lot for the industry, and it says a lot about the industry in 2017. And first and foremost, the lack of executive talent that I think is ready to move into these roles. If you look at the leadership and the names that keep coming up for these jobs, it's Jim Giannopoulos, who has been a studio executive for decades and is in his mid-60s. You know, Rob Friedman, who is the same kind of executive who previously was a Paramount executive and ran Summit and Lionsgate film. There isn't this next generation of executives that are coming up. And the question is why? And I think when you start to look at that question, you look at the nature of what it means to run a film studio these days. And in many ways, it's kind of depressing.
It's really unfun, yeah.
You're doing pre-branded comic book or toy brands or sequels or, you know, things that don't exactly let you flex your creative muscles very much. Or if you do flex your creative muscles, it's within a very limited, you know, wingspan. But then you look at the other areas of the industry and the other industries that are getting these top talents, and it's television, digital, Silicon Valley. These areas are much more appealing from a creative perspective than being essentially a brand manager at a film studio.
And really, what we've seen in a more broad sweep is all the studios acquired by bigger companies. They're all part of big companies now. And the management, it seems to me, a lot of the managers have become suits as opposed to these kind of more coloring outside the lines people who used to run these studios back, you know, I'm talking 15, 20 years ago. They're suits. They tend to manage up. They tend to, you know, protect themselves by not necessarily surrounding themselves with threatening talent. And so there's this vacuum behind a lot of them of people who are not groomed and, as you say, ready to take these positions. And if they are ready, they don't want to. So we're just at a strange point where people are really also wondering about the future of the movies generally, because as we've seen this past year dramatically, haves and have-nots. You know, Disney has sort of won the movies for now. Everybody else who's trying to copy them is having a much harder time.
Right. And there are fewer and fewer weekends throughout the calendar year where there isn't one of these pre-branded guaranteed blockbuster films already set for release. So you try to play the film game, and it used to be, there's a couple places we can take our swings. It's becoming increasingly difficult to even take those swings.
Meanwhile, of course, the unions are watching this with a wary eye and looking for opportunities to hold on to their muscle. They had a win after a long battle recently. These Telemundo actors voted overwhelmingly, in fact, to join SAG-AFTRA. We had a telenovela star, Pablo Azar, on The Business in November, and he was a big activist. I'll play a little clip from that interview when he talked about how it was really rather strange. He ended up at one point driving an Uber to try to supplement his income because he had no union benefits. And he said how different things were in, you know, Spanish language telenovelas as opposed to English language productions.
The moment you say, I love you, you get your benefits. The moment you say, te quiero mucho, you don't get your benefits. So that's the weird part, and that's the part that needs to change.
So you hear the difference. He said recently that he finally has a voice. And I think, Matt, the unions are going to look around in other places, right, to try to expand their reach.
Yeah, and you see this in other areas. And this is the first example of a Spanish language network group of talent organizing with SAG-AFTRA. But you're seeing it in other places. You know, the Writers Guild has recently had some success unionizing some writers at Vice and some writers at MTV News. So, you know, this is something that the guilds are pushing forward in many different areas.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new FX limited series Feud focuses on iconic actresses Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. Crawford started her film career in 1925 and Davis in 1930. And for years, it was known there was no love lost between the two. Davis famously turned down the role in Mildred Pierce, which won Crawford an Academy Award in 1945. But Davis wound up with two Oscars to Crawford's one. By the early 1960s, neither woman was getting much in the way of work. It was Crawford who found the horror novel Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, a tale of two reclusive sisters who had once enjoyed stardom. She approached Davis with an offer she believed would benefit them both. In Feud, Susan Sarandon plays Davis and Jessica Lange plays Crawford.
These are the parts of a lifetime.
No thanks, I've got plenty of better offers.
Bullshit. I know what kind of offers you've been getting. Exactly none, because the same is true for me. They're not making women's pictures anymore. Not the kind we used to make.
It's all cyclical. They'll come back in fashion.
But we won't. If something's going to happen, we have to make it happen. No one's looking to cast women our age. But together, they wouldn't dare say no.
Our guest today is Ryan Murphy, the creator of Feud, as well as other FX series, including American Horror Story and American Crime Story, the first season of which focused on the O.J. Simpson trial. The People vs. O.J. Simpson wowed critics and won 9 Emmys. Murphy also created the Fox shows Scream Queens and Glee. A year ago, Murphy founded the Half Foundation. He has pledged to hire women or minorities for at least 50% of the directing and crew slots across all of his shows. The idea came out of a moment Murphy describes as a crisis of faith.
I was directing The People vs. O.J. Simpson, and I directed 4 of them, and I was doing episode 6, Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. It was the episode that dealt with sexism and misogyny that Marsha Clark was dealing with. And I felt very strongly that I wanted a woman director, as did our other producers, and we lined one up. And then 2 weeks, I think, before we started pre-production, she had to do an emergency surgery on her leg. So she fell out. And it was a brief discussion of like, well, what do we do? And there's not a lot of time to prep. And I had directed Sarah and knew her so well that I just said that typical thing of, well, you know, I'll just do it. I'll just do it and we'll get it over with. And we did. And the episode turned out great. And Sarah was great.
It did indeed.
Won an Emmy.
Congratulations on all of it.
Thank you. But I felt I felt really bad because I felt that, okay, what's wrong with the structure of my business that I don't have 15 amazing female directors on speed dial? So I just started to examine my own complacency and, you know, looking at the industry average
which
in our
terrible,
business, which
course.
Is really bad. It's like only 15% of all directors in television are women and only 4 to 6% in film are women. So I just decided to do something, and I called up my boss, Dana Walden, and I told her the idea. She immediately said yes, and the mission statement of the Half Foundation is, from that moment on, 50% of all the directorial slots will be women in my company, and that's it. And I want to just sort of, maybe for the first time, quantify a number.
A specific goal. Mm-hmm.
Yes, as opposed to saying, we'll do better, we'll do more, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is always bullshit, in my opinion, because people don't really try. They don't try unless there's a goal to hit. It's
they
Hollywood
fall back
after
on
I.
the familiar. Or do you think it's just unconscious sexism or both?
I think it's apathy. And I think if you can just sort of not have to think about it, you won't. And I did it because it was a really personal thing. Because when I started off in 1998 directing, you know, it was my own show. I had to beg to direct an episode, which wouldn't have happened, I think, if I was a straight dude. This was like the Milch, Botchko, David E. Kelly period. And I remember I showed up on
these
the set.
Sort of Titanic showrunners.
Yes. And I showed up on set to direct my own show, and I was the only minority. Everybody else was white, straight men wearing Dockers and lumberjack shoes in their 50s. And I remember thinking, like, wow, I'm a stranger in a strange land, and I created the land. So that did not feel good. And then I had two children. And then I was bringing my children to set a lot as I would direct. So it was just a lot of things that happened in my life that I just decided to make a stance. And it's also about mentoring. Every director on my show is given somebody to take through the business and explain not just directing, but also pre-production and post. And a lot of times people have never been in an editing room. And more than that, I was stunned at how many single mothers were applying. And, you know, the system in Hollywood has always been, well, you come to us. We're not going to go to you. Maybe we'll let you work for free. And I was seeing with these women, like, they couldn't even be a part of the program, because then who's going to pay for the health care? So in my business, what I tried to do is pay them for following us.
The, like, child care. You.
Yeah. I mean, I give them a salary to learn is basically what it came down to. For several weeks, if you're in the half program, you are given a check. So you're not just sitting there, you know, living on hope and water and donuts, you know.
What do you look for when somebody comes and says, I mean, I'm sure like half the world would love to do this.
So we basically have 50 to 60 directorial slots a year, because I do anthological
you do a
series
lot of television.
For the most. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, well, they're going to be great if 10 people applied in a year. This month, 650 women have applied, which to me is both great, but also a tragedy, because it just shows, like, there's so many people with dreams who are not being recognized, who are not being served, who are not being listened to. So now I'm trying to get even more shows ordered so that there's more slots. I'm joking. But I feel it's a tragedy, and it's...
But how do you decide this one is the right one? I'm going to give this one the opportunity. Yeah.
Applicants go through a series of interviews, and they talk about their dreams, and they talk about what they're interested in doing. What I'm looking for is women who have personal stories, who want to get into the business to tell those stories and tell their perspectives and then bring other women with them. That's what I'm interested in. And what I've seen in the work is it leads to people speaking up and feeling the freedom to have opinions. Hmm. And I find that when women are directing, it's much more a community-based, well, what do you think? Women, I think, for some reason, are more free with inclusion and the idea of asking opinions. That doesn't mean that they're going to follow them, but I think that has been a great experience. And I've enjoyed bringing my kids to set even more, because it's a world I want to live in, and it's a world that I want them to grow up in, which was not a world I grew up in. So it's all just been a really remarkable and yet bittersweet experience, because, like I said, so many women want to do this work and they're just not being allowed to.
Now, you referred a while ago, you referred to Dana Walden as your boss. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering who actually is the boss of who in that relationship. You're very important to Fox.
Well, they're my bosses. I mean, John Landgraf and Dana Walden and Gary Newman and Peter Rice are the people I report to. I don't just get a walk in and say, I'm doing the show. Here's a green light.
I was going to ask, do you?
I think because...
Do they ever say no?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, of course. But when they do say no, they're right. And it's never a no. It's always, I understand why you're interested in this. I don't think A, it's ready, or B, it's what you should be doing. I have a very, very deep, interesting, long relationship with them. And I think of them part psychiatrist, part friend, part employee, because it's about, you know, careers are shifted and shaped. and they need mentors. And the thing that John and Dana are particularly good with me is sort of helping me focus, okay, what am I interested right now in the world? What am I interested in writing about? What am I interested in saying? And lean in towards that. And that's actually how Feud came about, because I was talking to all these women and I was talking to Dana and John about my outrage about it, because I would say to women, what could I do better? What can men do better? What can people in power do better? And what have been your experiences in Hollywood? So the themes that were coming up were ageism, misogyny, the idea that there's, you know, the it girl in Hollywood, which there's really, there's no it boy. Like, we are living in a culture of one woman at a time is allowed to have power, and that's it. And that's been around forever, particularly in Hollywood. So women fight for that one position. You don't see men doing that. So I was very interested in that. And from that came, okay, well, let's do Feud, because I had wanted to do that as a show. And I had had a different idea for season one. I originally was going to do Michael Bennett doing Dreamgirls versus Tommy Toon doing Nine, because they were friends. And then I was very interested in that. But as I got deeper into my exploration of the Half Foundation and I was talking about women's issues, I shifted more towards a female story. And I had owned this script from 2009, a Blacklist script that Brad Pitt and I and T.D. Gardner from Plan B, who are my partners on this, had bought. I'm like, well, I've always loved that story and I could never crack it as a movie. Jessica Lange and Susan Sarandon were attached, and they both were very interested in doing an 8-hour movie version of that as opposed to two, because you could just go deeper. And, you know, they didn't want to do the broad camp portrayal. So, but long story short is they do say no, but they're very good parents to me, you know, because they're like, I know you want to do that. Sit down a minute, take a breath. Let's, you know, it's that. That's my relationship with them.
You just announced that you're doing Charles and Diana. Mm-hmm. So you've got American Crime Story with Katrina coming up. I'm trying to keep it all sorted in my head.
No, I'm doing, I have American Crime Story. I'm doing Versace.
Oh, right, Versace.
Punan in first, and then after that we do Katrina. And then I have Feud, Betty now. And Joan mm-hmm. now, which is finished shooting. And then we do Charles and Diana in the fall. And then I have American Horror Story, which is going into its 7th season this September. And I have another show I'm developing that I hope to shoot later in the year.
But you also have you were going to do the election in, I'm trying.
That's on Horror Story.
On Horror Story. Yeah. I mean, you did it very successfully with People versus OJ. All very recognizable characters, you know, that are in the American consciousness. Mm-hmm. And Fox, you know, owned by Rupert Murdoch, no less. Do they ever go, you really want to touch that third? That's like, everybody will go insane, or good, everybody will go insane.
No, you know, because that's the thing that's the interesting thing about the media is that, you know, you say you're doing something like election themed and it's immediately a gut reaction of like, how dare he? It's too soon. Sometimes he just needs to be told no without reading a word of it. But I get that a lot. And I don't know why that is. I find it interesting. But, you know, we live in a world where...
A very reactive world, yeah.
Yeah. And I had the same thing happen with OJ. You know, when people found out that I was going to do the People versus OJ Simpson, it was a lot of, how dare he? And
I have
it's going
to
be a bloodbath.
I thought it was insane. And I put the first disc in, and within 60 seconds, I was absolutely hooked.
Were you?
Yes.
Well, thank you. People, you're right. They live in a very reactionary world, and they don't sort of wait to have an opinion. They have to have an instant opinion. And I find it to be very troubling and upsetting and dark.
But do you say, let's look for the thing that will cause a reaction?
No, I look for the thing I'm interested in. Always.
Coming up after a short break, OJ wasn't enough. Ryan Murphy tells us why he wants to bring the Monica Lewinsky story to television. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen, I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Ryan Murphy, creator of many TV shows, among them the new FX limited series Feud. The first season of Feud focuses on Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, who, after years of rivalry, formed an uneasy alliance to co-star in the 1962 horror drama Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. The first day on the set, Davis, played by Susan Sarandon, approaches Crawford, played by Jessica Lange.
All right, let's cut through the bull. I don't like you, you don't like me. But we need this picture to work, both of us. All I ask is that you do your best work. Try. Because when you're good, Joan, goddammit, you're good.
Do you really think so?
Oh, Christ, you're not going to cry. Yes, I really think so. I've always thought so. Oh, one last thing. Lose the shoulder pads.
I beg your pardon.
And cut back on the lipstick. You're playing a recluse who hasn't seen the sun for 20 years, for Christ's sake.
In his earlier American Crime Story series, People vs. O.J., certain characters, such as Sterling K. Brown's Chris Darden, bore a striking resemblance to the people they were playing. In other cases, such as Cuba Gooding's O.J. Simpson, there's not that much likeness. I asked Murphy how much he cares about casting lookalikes or at least look-similars.
I never just cast on physicality alone because then you're just doing puppetry, you know? I'm looking for essence. I don't want to do mimicry. So, for example, when we did Bette and Joan,
right?
Like, you know, Susan has always been told she looks like Bette Davis, right? And she'd been offered Bette Davis five times. So there was a physical thing there.
Right.
Jessica Lange looks nothing like Joan Crawford. But, you know, then you do things with lighting and hair and you know, no better actress. So I was interested in doing the anti-mommy dearest Joan Crawford.
Although I will say that your Joan Crawford is not what I would call a model of stability.
Well, she's not. No, poor Joan. But she's a real person and she's nuanced and there's light and dark. It's not just all one thing. But when I'm casting, it's always just also with me, like, who do I love and who am I interested in and who have I always wanted to work with? Susan was one of those people. Kathy Bates was one of those people. Catherine Zeta-Jones, Stanley Tucci.
Yeah. You wrote to Bette Davis when you were young.
I did.
Right?
I was 10. I was somewhere around 8, 9.
What inspired a young kid to love Bette Davis and write to her? I mean, she's awesome.
I was very much raised by my grandmother. I spent a lot of time with her. And one night I snuck down late and turned on the television. And the first thing I saw of hers was The Letter, where she barrels out of the house firing a gun. And I just instantly thought, that reminds me a lot of my grandmother. Not so much the murderous thing, but just the energy and the intensity. I didn't figure this out till much therapy and much later on, but I felt in some ways I knew her. And I also, the more I got to realize her dreams and potential, the more I related to her, because she was somebody who never fit in a box. She created her own definition of what success was and what it was meant to be powerful. And I always loved that about her.
I haven't seen the entire arc yet, but mm-hmm. I do sort of sense the connection to Bette. I mean, did you feel that you wanted to really balance the two sides of the feud, or is it okay to kind of shade a little one way more than the other?
No, the episodes are really balanced, you know? And we literally would go through and make sure that both women were given equal screen time. And Jessica and Susan were very good about that, trying to make sure that it was not a one-hander, but a two-hander, and often about supporting the other actor.
Which is the precise opposite of what you're portraying.
The exact opposite. So I thought, well, that's great, and we've come a little far there. But it was interesting. I went into the project, obviously, because I had known Bette Davis. I had an affinity towards her. Joan Crawford, I had always been interested in, but when I was doing the show, I grew to have much more love and affection for her as time went on, because I do feel she was so misunderstood. And I do feel that both women were really misunderstood. Joan, perhaps more than Bette, because, you know, after Mommy Dearest, she's been sort of frozen in amber and seen as this sort of Gorgon.
Cartoon character.
Yeah. So I think by the time you get to the end of it, I hope that you'll feel that, you know, I loved them equally, because I did. I did.
And so let's talk for a second, you know, Monica Lewinsky. And I mean, there's a very awkward moment with the Oval Office where, yeah, I don't know. How do you think, are we going to show that?
I don't know. You know, it's sort of, we're working on the scripts, and the book that we're basing it off of is written by Jeffrey Toobin, who wrote The People versus O.J. Simpson, who wrote the Monica book. So right then and there, Jeffrey is an amazing reporter. So you start with a great collaborator. And so, like OJ, there is a choice, as there always is in anything, to sort of, are we going to lean into the salacious? No, that's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the birth of the alt-right movement with the Monica Lewinsky story.
Oh, that's an interesting lens.
Yeah.
I mean, you've given fundraisers for Hillary Clinton, have you not? Or did I make
that up? I have.
So did you call her up and say, so, you know, remember, I raised a lot of money for you, so I'm going to do this now?
No, because I think that anybody who knows me knows that I would not go after Hillary Clinton in that way. Jeffrey's book is not in a character assassination of anybody, except it's sort of trying to explain the Ken Starr and the birth of the, you know, the Tea Party movement and the alt-right all came out of a swirling hatred of the Clintons and Democratic power. So it's like OJ, it's a way to start, I think, looking at what's going on today.
Knowing what I know about the Clintons, their immediate reaction would be, please don't do this.
Probably. My phone hasn't rung. And my phone has rung other times from people who are like, yeah, don't do that, or please don't do that.
But, what do you say when you get the don't do that call?
Well, I, for example, we're working on Versace Cunanan. Yes. But I'm sure Donatella Versace is not thrilled we're doing that, and I've heard as much. But, you know, my response to that was, well, I'm sure Marcia Clark wasn't thrilled when we did The People versus O.J. Simpson.
And then it turned out quite well.
I'm not interested in damaging or vilifying anybody, particularly women. So I would never go into something like, you know, the Monica situation. I would never do anything that would hurt Monica or Hillary. But I'm not interested in the salacious nature of the story, just as I'm not, wasn't interested in the salacious.
Well, it is inevitably somewhat of a salacious, it's like there's a murder in OJ and there's a fill in the blank.
But I guess it depends. How do you do it? What do you lean into as a filmmaker?
So is it sort of like, trust me, I'm going to do this right?
I never say trust me.
No. Don't trust me.
You
call up and say, can we buy your rights? You just figure this is public.
We have a book. The book has a very specific point of view, as did The People versus O.J. Simpson. But I don't know. I always find it confusing when people are so quick to outrage and indignation with the things that I'm interested in writing about, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it just seems to me that surely they're going to leap to a conclusion. And then, of course, the brilliance and the interesting thing is to execute in a way that surprises and informs, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've always been somebody who's, I love history and I'm a child and a creature of pop culture, you know. I'm interested in, particularly now in my career, writing and doing things that have always touched me as a person, you know, in an emotional way. I never go into anything thinking anything but affection, usually for the people I'm writing about, because why would you want to spend so much time with them in your brain and in your life? And I had to find my way into that. But that's what I felt about Marcia Clark. That's what I felt about Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. That's what I feel about Princess Diana. That's what I feel about.
Can I find that for Charles too?
Yeah. I mean, sure. Anybody who's strangled by duty. Absolutely. I relate to that part of him too. Yeah. And Katrina too, you know?
Yeah. Are you going to have like a George Bush in there and Brownie?
We do have George Bush. Yes. But I'm like, that's the interesting thing. Like, I'm not interested in a buffoon George Bush. I'm interested in like, how did he get to the point where he let a lot of these decisions slide? What was the psychology of him? And of course, it's draft after draft and smart people like Landgraf and Dana Walden and Nina and Brad. So I try and just surround myself by people who say, not good enough, keep working harder. Like, that's the best you can hope for. I like a lot of opinions. I didn't when I was younger, but now I sort of am of this mindset of the best, strongest opinion wins. That's what I try and do.
Ryan Murphy is the executive producer of Feud, Betty and Joan on FX, and producer, director of so many other things, I can't even. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.